Aloha, I'm speaking today on 10 years of geographic, temporal, and demographic trends in U.S. asthma prevalence. I'm going to begin with a brief background information that sets this investigation in context, followed by usual brief descriptions of our objectives, the methods, results, and some brief conclusions. And we have no relationships to disclose. There is no universal definition for asthma, but the National Institutes for Health recognize the importance of inflammation in this disorder of the airways. Overall, asthma is a serious health condition of the respiratory system characterized by wheezing and difficulty breathing, and this can manifest as acute life-threatening episodes or as long-term chronic illness, and of course, this can significantly degrade quality of life. Asthma is widely recognized as a condition of complex etiology with many causative factors that can interact over both space and time. For example, environmental triggers such as indoor allergens, molds, air pollutants, and respiratory viruses can individually or together interact to lead to the development of asthma or to trigger asthma events. These factors interact with inherent biologic vulnerability, and the frequency and severity of asthma is largely related to management, which in turn is related to one's biological and physiological responses to treatment. Asthma is very common in the United States. About 8% of the U.S. population is affected, and some groups exhibit higher asthma prevalence than others. For example, females, those with lower socioeconomic status, smokers, the overweight and obese, have higher prevalence of asthma. In addition, some race and ethnicities exhibit higher prevalence of asthma, for example, blacks and Native Americans. And asthma exhibits an inverse relationship with age, such that children and young adults are more affected. And there have been numerous studies that have found correlations between air pollution and development of asthma condition and symptoms. Due to the complex etiology of asthma, monitoring prevalence at the population level, I think, can rather serve as a canary in the coal mine to bring our attention to latent public health issues such as health disparities and environmental triggers. In the United States, unfortunately, asthma is a growing epidemic. For example, between 1980 and 1996, prevalence doubled. Moreover, this increase in prevalence was positively correlated with increases in mortality. In 2001, 1 in 14 people had asthma, and by 2009, that had increased to 1 in 12 people, or about 25 million people in the United States. These data are from the CDC and show the percent of people in the U.S. with asthma with time from 2001 to 2009. And the yellow line shows total asthma prevalence and the gradual increase in the last several years. Asthma is also known to substantially vary geographically, although for reasons not well understood. These data are also from the CDC, a single year of prevalence estimates by state level. And here, states highlighted in the darker green have much higher prevalence of asthma than the light green states. However, these prevalence estimates do not account for the sociodemographics of the particular states. And so our objectives were to describe the prevalence of asthma and its temporal changes over the past 10 years amongst U.S. states, and to look at geographic and temporal trends in asthma prevalence accounting for sociodemographic characteristics of states. Our project utilized 10 years of data from 2001 to 2010 from the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. And this is the annual state-based telephone survey that's conducted by the CDC with about 350,000 interviews per year. I understand it's the largest telephone survey in the world. and data are self-reported from one adult per household. Our outcome variable was lifetime asthma, and this is defined as a positive response to the question, have you ever been told by a doctor, nurse, or other health professional that you had asthma? Our covariates were race, age, gender, education level, whether you had health care coverage or not, smoking status, BMI, state, and the data were concatenated into 5 different 2-year time periods. We use SAS and SAS Callable Sudan, which has algorithms to account for the complex survey design. And we use these software to generate descriptive frequency distributions and to conduct chi-square tests and logistic regressions. These tables show the raw sample size of the data set. There were about 3.2 million records for the entire 10-year data set. Most respondents were white, had health care coverage, were never smokers, and were either overweight or obese. The other characteristic groups of age, gender, and education were more evenly distributed in the sample set. We defined areas of the region of the geographic regions within the United States according to the U.S. Census Bureau definitions as shown here. Sample size was a little bit larger in the South, and each of the 5 different 2-year time periods contributed about 20% to the overall data set. These data show the stratum-specific weighted estimates of lifetime asthma prevalence in the 10-year data set, and certain groups had much higher crude asthma prevalence, and these included those of black race, the youngest age group from years 18 to 24, females, those of the lowest education attainment level, current and former smokers, and the obese. Certain groups had significantly lower crude asthma prevalence, and those were Asians, 65 years or older, males, those with a college degree, and never smokers, and those of normal BMI. Asthma prevalence was significantly higher in the West and Northeast, and crude asthma prevalence significantly increased from the earliest time period of 2001-2002 to the last time period of 2009-2010. So In the two-year time period 2009-2010, crude asthma prevalence was overall about 13.5%. Crude odds ratios from the univariate logistic regressions better indicate the magnitude of these associations. Again, these same groups that I just mentioned had increased odds for lifetime asthma. And the areas of the West and Northeast had significantly greater odds for lifetime asthma. And these are all previously known associations, and so these results confirm previously known risk factors for asthma. We used a multivariate logistic regression model to adjust these crude odd ratios for potential confounders. And after adjustment for all covariates, the same groups continued to exhibit increased odds for asthma. The younger age group had especially high odds for asthma, as did current and former smokers and the obese. In the West and Northeast, asthma prevalence was 15 to 20% higher than in the Midwest and South. And in the adjusted odds ratio, asthma had increased by about 20%. Some of the adjusted odds ratios indicated that the crude odds ratios had been negatively confounded. That is, after adjustment, the odds for asthma had increased within that strata. So in the West and Northeast, the adjusted odds were a little bit larger. And in addition, in the multivariate model, there was an association between having health care coverage and having an EVER diagnosis of asthma, as you might expect. However, associations with asthma did vary geographically. So these data show the adjusted odds in the West, Midwest, South, and Northeast. And so, for example, healthcare coverage was associated with lifetime asthma prevalence strongly in the West and Northeast, but that association was non-existent and in the Midwest. Similarly, for Black race, there was a strong association with asthma prevalence, but this association was not significant in the South, surprisingly. Those having a low education attainment level had a strong association with having asthma everywhere in the country except in the West. However, all areas of the country exhibited an increase in asthma prevalence with time in the multivariate model. Looking at states individually within their geographic region, in the West, the states without a red dot have relatively low asthma prevalence, and those states marked with a red dot have odds for asthma that are about 20% or more above the reference states. And so states with particularly high asthma prevalence include Arizona, Washington, Oregon, and Hawaii. In the Midwest, the states of South Dakota, Iowa, North Dakota, and Nebraska had relatively low asthma prevalence, but several states had high prevalence of at least 20% more than those reference states. And in the Midwest, Michigan is the state with the highest adjusted odds for asthma. In the South, Louisiana and Mississippi have low odds for asthma, but many of the other southern states have odds that are greater than that by at least 20%. And odds for asthma in the multivariate model were highest in the District of Columbia. And finally, in the Northeast, New Jersey and Pennsylvania were the states with the lowest asthma prevalence, but then the remainder of the states in the Northeast had about equivalent and greater odds for asthma. Looking at all of the states together, I've highlighted in red the states that would be considered asthma capitals in the United States, and these are states with greater odds for asthma of 50% above the reference states. And these include a cluster of high asthma prevalence in the Northeast, a few states in the West, Oregon, Washington, and Arizona, and then Hawaii is the state with the highest odds for asthma at 1.83. So in conclusion, race, young age, female sex, lower education attainment, smoking, and obesity are associated with asthma after controlling for other risk factors, including region of the country and time. Adjusted odds for asthma have increased by about 20% in all regions of the U.S. over the last 10 years. And temporal increases in asthma prevalence are probably likely not due to changes in sociodemographics, at least those that were measured in this study. Especially high asthma prevalence in the West and Northeast persists after adjustment for sociodemographics. And I think that national asthma prevention efforts should focus on education in areas outside of the West, and should focus on aspects of healthcare access, especially in the South and Midwest. And of course, additional research is needed regarding the drivers of the U.S. asthma epidemic and their roles in the geographic differences in asthma that we see in the United States. I'd like to extend mahalo or thanks to my committee, as well as scholarships from the University of Hawaii at Mauna Loa Graduate Division the Delta Omega Honor Society in Public Health, and the Pfizer APHA Travel Scholarship.
What's the question? Sushin study, it is still the first step. So we would like to see that if there are genes in human genome, they are highly associated with alcohol dependence. That's the first step. Yeah. Next step, we need to look at the SNP functions, which means that within the gene, first we look at the gene function, then we need to know the functional genetic variant within the gene. Normally, one gene is very large. There are many genetic variations there, but we need to look at which the small area within the gene has function for the disease. That's the general idea. So the association is just the first step. And also, actually, the genome-wide association study are still new. The first genome-wide association study was published in 2004 about Parkinson's disease. In alcohol dependence, the first genome-wide association study was published in 2009. So it is still new. There are a lot of things we need to do in the future.
So we probably soon need to move on to the second paper. Are you okay moving on?
Okay.
Thank you. We'll move on. So the second paper was Jessica, and this was related to diabetes in Puerto Rico. Any comments or questions related to that paper? I'm just curious. And yet quite a few were also on insulin. Did you know whether most of the diabetes was type 1 or type 2?
We doesn't have that kind of information because in the survey that
comes here so that everyone can.
Okay, so we don't have that kind of information because in this survey it is not asked
if the person is type 1 or 2 or type 2 diabetes. So that is an excellent question, and we would like to assess that in the future, and we're working in adding some questions in the future in the diabetes optional model, and that's one of the questions that I want to add.
So how we selected the population, that's a really good question. I've got a pretty short answer. You know, the providers, I don't want to say they handpicked the patients, but they were patients that had been identified over the last couple of years that were at high risk, that they found to be non-adherent to medications, lifestyle changes, and any other part of their diabetes therapy. So it wasn't by HbA1c, or any of the other values, but just a group of patients that they felt really needed more intensive counseling.
Okay.
Yeah. So the question was, did the education occur in the provider's office? Yes. Yes, they did, yeah. So, you know, we ran into the normal issues with getting patients back into the office for something other than, you know, a regularly scheduled appointment. These were educational appointments, so I think there was, you know, maybe some concern whether or not the patient valued those or not, and actually getting them to come in. So the more we thought about the project, the more variables we thought that we could have followed as well. You know, how long were they taking the classes? It was over a 12-month period. So on average, the patients were scheduled for 6 educational appointments during that time period. Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, and now we'll move on to the next paper, Jimmy Moraki. Very interesting and unusual project on the headache and the fruit eater. Yeah, I'm happy. And repeat the question.
Okay.
Very interesting.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I usually suffer from headaches after watching a 3D movie. So, what I wanted to ask is that you said that the survey was administered after watching the movie. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But you also said that it was an internet survey. So, how did they go back to their houses and then took the survey? How was that process?
Well, because it was a class assignment and we didn't have that much time, we kind of made it into a retrospective that we handed out the surveys to people and said, please comment on if you have seen a 3D movie or the one group that did 2D versus 3D, the last movie that you saw.
Okay. And you know, when
that
period of time, what was it?
It was in the past year.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Maybe you just answered it because you said retrospective, but I was curious how you managed to get exempt IRB status if you were doing actually sort of an interventional study and you were showing someone a 3D movie that could in fact precipitate a migraine. It seems like that could it even be low, moderate, high risk study.
Mm-hmm. So this class actually does a small epi study every year, so we have a nice relationship with the IRB, and they expect it every year, so that's why we get the exempt status. It usually takes about a week after we submit it for them to get back to us. And because it was anyone who saw the 3D movie on their own time we didn't really have to worry
so it
about.
Retrospective.
It was retrospective, yes. We did. We asked the specific movie that they saw, but due to lots of copyright and sort of problems like that, we couldn't really separate them saying, you know, this many people got a headache from Avatar or this movie. So we were kind of tiptoeing around specifically pinpointing certain movies. And it was also very hard because so many movies came out. It was approximately 30 to 35 in the past year or two. So just because we had such low sample sizes, we didn't know if we could actually stratify it based on movie.
And what do you think would be like pathogenesis of why the prescription eyeglasses plus the 3D glasses would be a risk factor but not contacts?
Well, we weren't super sure. I was actually looking before I came here, and now they have special 3D polarized things that they can just, you can snap on, kind of like the sunglasses. So it might be just a comfort level that's a problem with people who, because we did ask what specific type of vision problems they had, and we didn't really find that people who are nearsighted or farsighted experienced more headaches than others. So it really has to be either the wearing of the double glasses, or some looked at, you have better vision correction if you're wearing contacts because it's closer to your eye compared to, you still have, you know, perception problems with everything, so that might be an effect if you're looking off to the side and your glasses aren't covering it.
And then the, in general, pathogenesis of the 3D movies causing headaches has to do with this issue of it can...
of the divergence and accommodation conflict, which most people agree with is the reason, but there's no way that they can really tell if that's the reason why you get headaches.
Fascinating.
Thank you.
You got it.
Thank you. We did not look at allergies. I believe the BRFSS does ask questions regarding that, so that may be an avenue of future investigation. Regarding location of metropolitan versus rural, that's actually a project that I'm just beginning to undertake. I'm interested in looking at correlations between air pollution levels in metropolitan areas and asthma prevalence. So this project was kind of the seed to kind of get me started working with BRFSS, and we're going to expand what we're looking at based on this project.
Why do you think there is such a steep increase in prevalence in Hawaii?
That's another future avenue of investigation. I'm going to be using the Hawaii Health Survey data set to look at differences in asthma prevalence on windward versus leeward sides of the islands. For those who are not familiar with Hawaii, windward sides of the islands are much more damp and wet, which could promote more abundance of molds, and molds are a common trigger for asthma. So personally, I think asthma may be higher in Hawaii because of some environmental factors such as molds. Hawaii does have very good air quality in general, so air pollution is probably not an issue, although that's not true for some specific areas of Hawaii where the volcano is active. But overall, we're interested in looking at mold and asthma to try to see if that is a potential issue in that particular state.
I'd like to just follow up on that. I was sort of surprised that in the region where Arizona was, that Arizona had a high prevalence, and it's because I always thought, oh, people move to Arizona too often to to resolve those issues.
Exactly.
Is that a reason that the prevalence is high? Is because people move there and they have asthma?
That could be a potential hypothesis to explore also. I was thinking it might have to do with demographics of age, because Arizona is also a large retirement state, and in connection with the question on looking at other comorbidities such as allergies, we could also look at other comorbidities such as COPD, which is often confused with asthma.
Right. So that's sort of like
yes.
Your answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Is that addressed or somehow encompassed in that, or is it just do you have asthma and it's up to them to decide if that qualifies or not?
We did not include physical activity as one of our covariates, but again, that may be possible to do in the future because BRFSS does ask about physical activity, so we could add that as a potential covariate to look for associations with asthma prevalence. BRFSS also has the asthma callback survey, in which those who have said, yes, I have had an EVER diagnosis of asthma, are called back later, and they are queried on a number of health-related questions specific to asthma, and some of those include physical activity and exercise-induced problems. So that would be another area to explore. What's that? I'm not familiar with RAD. What does that stand for?
Reactive airway disease.
I'm not familiar with that.
It actually has its own code and such, and it's
okay.
It tends to be a common term that's used with younger children.
Okay.
Kind of as a way to not say asthma for whatever reason. There's some cultural and all kinds of other issues with that, but it tends to disappear as a diagnosis as a child.
Oh, I see.
So it's very interesting. I'm not in a position to listen to
BRFSS is focused on adult population. There are some data on children in BRFSS, but for the most part it's focused on adults. And so I don't believe that they have a question regarding RAD in that survey, possibly for that reason, if it's more associated with children. We were looking at lifetime asthma, which is, have you ever been told that you have asthma? BRFSS also asks, if you have had a diagnosis, do you currently have asthma? And that's another outcome measure that I'd like to look at as well.
Okay, we better close.